You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 2014 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the fifth class in a series given by Brother Adam Burns on the subject, Learning to Lean. This class is titled, Learning to Lean.
Well, good morning, brothers and sisters and everyone. Yes, our last day. It's a bit sad, isn't it? Our last day of classes. Well, this morning we're going to look at four incidents. We're going to look at Shechem and the return to Bethel, and we looked at that briefly on Sunday evening. And we just want to pick up one other point in relation to the return from Uncle Laban's to Shechem and then Bethel. We're going to have a look at Rachel's death. And in a sense also Jacob's death as he becomes Israel. Then we're going to look at Joseph's death and Jacob's journey to Egypt. And finally we'll finish in Hebrews 11 with Jacob, Ephraim and Manasseh. But yesterday we left Jacob after that wrestle with the dawning of the new day, you'll remember poetically. We finished with him limping with the sunrise, backlighting his journey towards Israel. And as we discussed in exhortation last Sunday, he stops at the very entrance of the land, as if it were at the letterbox in the driveway. He stops at the entrance to the land and he makes himself comfortable outside the Canaanite city of Shechem. And things, as we know, don't go to plan for Jacob. In chapter 34... Dinah is raped by Shechem, and Jacob's proximity to that city led to the interaction of his family with the family of Hamor and Shechem, and the ultimate defilement and humiliation of Dinah. And it's interesting that two options are proposed to kind of sort out this mess. Hamor, he offers intermarriage, shared trade and shared property. He says, I know how we're going to sort this out. Let's just intermarry. Let's kind of become one. Let's trade together. Let's share our property. Let's share our wealth and abundance. And as we know from Deuteronomy chapter 7, intermarriage between Israel and the Hivites, who are descendants of Canaan, is forbidden. So it certainly wasn't an option that Jacob pursued. I think it's interesting to note what Jacob's sons propose to kind of sort out this mess. They propose circumcision. Circumcision, of course, is a sign of the covenant, right? So while they propose that, I think it's interesting that their proposal is completely free of any reference to God or the covenant that the circumcision relates to. I mean, the proposal is ludicrous, isn't it? That the proposal is that a rape can be compensated for and a marriage paid for by this outward symbol. And what the sons are doing here is they're making the symbol of the religion itself. The sign becomes the religion. And Hamor and Shechem, they foolishly agree to this, and we know what subsequently occurs. And I think there's just a little sort of lesson or to pull from this example. And that's the lesson of making the mistake of turning a symbol, or should I say in our circumstances, a tradition or even a preference, into the religion itself, and kind of losing the core fundamental of what the symbol or the preference or the tradition has its basis in. And so, you know, as a community, we do have, you know, little things that we like to do and traditions and so on. And I guess we just need to be careful that if we can't find scriptural proof or clear scriptural direction for the religious preferences or traditions in our community or in your ecclesia, then we should just be very careful, obviously, to impose these stylistic preferences on others. I have no problem with people having their own stylistic preferences, their own methods of worshipping God, even if ecclesias choose to do that collectively. But if there's no core fundamental basis or direction, then we need to be careful not to take the symbol of the religion, make it the religion, and force that upon others. Because, of course, doing that does a disservice to the core things that unite us. And so Jacob is once again, the circumcision, the subsequent massacre of the town, is in the middle of a mess, a total family mess. But this mess, in some ways, is very different to all the other messes in his life to date. We're used to Jacob and him being in a mess. What's the difference? Why is this a different mess to all the other messes? Yeah, say it again, louder and prouder. This is the first time that Jacob isn't making the mess. He made a mistake. He went and sort of lived close to Shechem. But this mess that emerges out of the circumcision and the massacre is his son's mess. We're accustomed to him, you know, doing all this conniving, clever, plotting, pulling off a great swift deal, all that kind of stuff. We're used to that. For the first time, no, this is the son's mess. It's not Jacob's mess. And things are slowly starting to change. And so he responds in fear, and he says to his sons about this family mess, he said, "You have troubled me to make me to stink among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites, and I being few in number, they shall gather themselves together against me and slay me, and I shall be destroyed, I and my house." And on Sunday, we made the point, well, what is it that God does? God intervenes, and God takes him back to Bethel, back to that spiritual anchor point, that point where God says, "Don't worry, it doesn't matter about the circumstances, I'm yours, I'm with you," and takes him back there to reboot and reset him and remind him that God is with him. And of course, also to remind Jacob that he made a promise that God would be his also. And so this time, the arrival back to Bethel is important. It's marked by God appearing, by God restating the covenant promise when he gets back to Bethel, restating that he would be named Israel. Of course, the angel had told him he'd be named Israel. Again, it's stated here. And Jacob responds by setting up a pillar of stones and pouring out a drink offering on the stones. And so although the angel had told him that his name would change, it's repeated again in chapter 35, verse 10. And God said to him, "Your name is Jacob. No longer shall you be called Jacob, but Israel shall be your name." So he called his name Israel. So what does Israel mean normally? What do we as Christadelphians say? It means prince. Prince with God, yeah? So that's kind of our common understanding. I find, and I've just had a look at what others say in terms of what Israel means, and I think it's kind of revealing. Josephus, he says it means one that struggled with the divine angel. That's what Israel means. Rashi, one who has prevailed with God. Whiston, a man seeing God. Strong, he will rule as God. And the one that the Christadelphians tend to ascribe to the meaning of Israel too is Morris's a prince with God. So I'm comfortable with the prince with God, but I think all of them are really interesting and all quite relevant. Each one, I mean, particularly those that talk about struggling and prevailing. They're kind of opposite ideas, aren't they, to being a prince with God? A prince with God isn't quite someone who is wrestling, struggling, prevailing with God. And I think in some ways this name is a perfect fit for Jacob, for Israel, at almost every time of his life. You can take this name and say, oh, okay, at some stage, yes, he was struggling, he was prevailing, sometimes he did see God, and I don't think we're yet to see a prince with God. I think that's also interesting when we think about natural Israel today. In our newspapers dramatically at the moment. I mean, which one of these definitions apply to natural Israel today? struggling, yeah? It'd be Josephus or Rashi, yeah? Like, in a sense, Israel's having, it's kind of prevailing over God in that kind of poetic sense at the moment. God's not sort of prevailing amongst that land at the moment. So in natural Israel, sort of here at the moment, and we trust that spiritual Israel will end up here. And so I just think the names are kind of a perfect fit for Jacob in every one of its interpretations. I just want to keep going with this name because I think the Bible's at pains to just sort of focus on his name. And the name Israel is given greater weight in the next event, which is the sad death of Rachel. If you could come with me to Genesis chapter 35, please. Genesis 35, verses 16 to 21. Then they journeyed from Bethel. When they were still some distance from Ephrath, Rachel went into labour and she had hard labour. And when her labour was at its hardest, the midwife said to her, "Do not fear, for you have another son." And as her soul was departing, for she was dying, she called his name Ben-Oni. But his father called him Benjamin. So Rachel died, and she was buried on the way to Ephrath, that is Bethlehem. And Jacob set up a pillar over her tomb. It is the pillar of Rachel's tomb, which is there to this day. Israel journeyed on and pitched his tent beyond the tower of Edah. So did anyone notice a subtle change in language in those verses? Who buries Rachel? Verse 19 or 20, I think it is there. It changes from Jacob to Israel. So Jacob buries her. Jacob sets up a pillar. But who journeys on? It's Israel. And what other little thing does it say about Israel? What does he do just after he leaves there? He, verse 21, journeyed on and pitch his tent. I mean, there's some kind of echoes happening here, yeah? So you've got this kind of little wordplay going on. Little wordplay about Jacob coming in, Israel leaving, and that echo. Moses is writing this book. There's that echo again to tent living. And it's something that Micah picks up on also. Because going into Ephrath is Jacob and Rachel. That's who goes in. Jacob and Rachel go in. But leaving Ephrath is Israel and Benjamin. Benjamin means son of the right hand. That's right. So Micah says, picking up on this kind of little wordplay here, he says that out of Bethlehem, Ephratah will come the ruler in Israel. So we've got this little wordplay going on, this little play of natural Israel dying and spiritual Israel emerging. And it kind of looks like this. So naturally, Rachel dies, but out of that death, the son of the right hand is born in Bethlehem. Whoops. Jacob dies, but Israel emerges. So the supplanter, the wrestler dies, and the Prince of God comes out of that place. Natural Israel dies, spiritual Israel emerges. One who struggles with God is left back in that place, and a Prince with God emerges. I think that's an interesting little wordplay, but it continues this kind of idea that you're starting to see a change, a shift in who Jacob is. And the record of Israel, of Jacob, I think is at pains to point out from this point on a change. And I think it's quite remarkable. There's still many years to play out in Jacob's life, and yet the word really only records a few stories, a few events, and I think it does so intentionally trying to identify this changed man. And the record is at pains to see whose will is at play. Is it Jacob's will? That's been his problem to date. Or is it God's will that's at play? Is it Jacob or is it Israel? And we don't really need this verse in the Bible, I don't think, necessarily. And yet we've got to ask, well, why is it here? While Israel lived in that land, Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine, and Israel heard of it. So inexplicably, Reuben lays with Jacob's concubine. And I think the natural question that emerges out of this is, well, what's going to happen now? What is Jacob going to do about this? There's insolence here. There's probably a bit of a power play going on with the eldest son trying to kind of take over dad. What is Jacob going to do to make this right? And can you remember what he does? What he does is incredible. Just immediately after it, can you remember what Jacob does? I didn't think so, because Jacob does nothing. Jacob is dead. Israel now lives. Israel is not the same man who existed in our studies to date. That man of the birthright and the blessing and the guy who sort of wrestled with the angel, that man is diminishing. He's waiting more and more on the will of God. Now, of course, there is a response much later when he blesses the sons in Genesis chapter 49, and he allows God's justice to prevail. But, you know, why do we have to know about this? Because of the way Jacob responds. Now, it's not a one-off event. We're going to see this a couple more times yet. But let's now just think about this sad day. Kind of think about Jacob and Joseph, who it says in Genesis 37, Israel loved more than any other of his sons because he was the son of his old age. And so at the end of chapter 37, we have this gut-wrenching account. Jacob in dire sadness, he's tearing his clothes, he's putting on sackcloth, he's completely inconsolable despite the best efforts of the rest of his family. He knows that for the rest of his days, that they would be full of mourning and sadness, always remembering the child that he'd lost and weeping for Joseph. And no father wants for this. This is hideous to read. Rachel's son, his Joseph, is lost to him forever. And the record, I guess, follows Joseph from this point on. Joseph's sold, goes to Potiphar's house, prison. At the age of 30, he comes to serve Pharaoh, and he spent at least 7 years preparing Egypt for 7 years of famine. And the famine affects Israel, and Jacob in chapter 42 sends his sons to Egypt for food. And we recall that kind of anxious story. It's kind of pretty tense, I find, when you read that sort of story of Joseph and the brothers, with the tense kind of tricks and Joseph setting up his brothers and making sure the others came back and so on. And I guess the way Joseph is interested in what's going on with his father and so on. And I just want to pick up this story in chapter 46, if you could come to that. Oh, sorry, chapter 45. I think I've got that. Do I have that here? No, I don't. So chapter 45, and we'll read just verses 25 to 28 together. So they went up out of Egypt, these are the brothers, and came to the land of Canaan to their father Jacob. And they told him, Joseph is still alive and he's ruler over all the land of Egypt. And his heart became numb, for he did not believe them. But when they told him all the words of Joseph which he had said to them, and when he saw the wagons that Joseph had sent to carry him, the spirit of their father Jacob revived, and Israel said, it's enough. Joseph, my son, is alive. I will go and see him before I die. And so Jacob packs up the family, the large family, the servants, the campsite, orders the animals, gets everyone together, and he heads south to Egypt to see his boy. His favourite boy, once dead, but now alive. And I just want us to try and enter into the emotion of this event. Such elation, such joy. I want you to try and just stand in his shoes as he heads south to see his boy. Because today, for me, when I think of Jacob at his best, It's this day. It's actually this evening. We're just going to have a little look at it. It's one of those little sleepers in the record where you think, this is Jacob at his most triumphant. Chapter 46, verses 1-4. So Israel took his journey with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. And God spoke to Israel in visions of the night, and he said, Jacob, Jacob. And he said, here am I. Then he said, I am God, the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for there I will make you into a great nation. I myself will go down with you to Egypt, and I will also bring you up again, and Joseph's hand shall close your eyes. And Jacob gets to the southern tip of the land. He gets to Beersheba. The next stop is Egypt. You can see Egypt over the hill, lay Egypt and his boy. And what does he do? I cannot believe the first few verses of chapter 46. He stops and he waits for God. And in verse 3, we're given an insight into what he was thinking as God says to him in a dream, don't be afraid. It's okay to go down to Egypt. I'm okay with you heading down to Egypt. I'll be with you. I mean, if it was your child, would you stop? Would you pause? Would you even give God a chance, a skerrick of a chance to get in the way? I certainly would not. There would be not a thing that would stand between me and there. I would not allow God that opportunity. Jacob, I think, risks here God's answer. God potentially stands between him and his son, and Jacob does tonight in Beersheba what he's never been able to do before in his entire life. And he does it now. Of all times, he does it now, when he could be forgiven for just rushing to his son's side. He finally stops, pauses, and he waits for God. The wrestling is over. He has relinquished all control to God. He's an old man. He'll soon be dead. And finally, God has prevailed. He wrestled with God all night, all life. But tonight, in Beersheba, God has prevailed. And so Hosea doesn't just give us a history lesson about Jacob. Hosea is providing a commentary about life before God, about fidelity, about relationship, how he wants us to be in a relationship with him, about our marriage to him, about the stages of discipleship. He says, I want you to come back to me, much like all of us want that with our loved ones. Just return back to me. Hold on to me and just wait continually. Be patient. Just wait continually with God. That's where we need to get to. Hosea saw a progression. He saw a spiritual evolution at play. And so, at first glance, when I look at Abraham, I can see a great Bible character. I'm sure you can too. First glance, you look at Abraham, you think, what a big journey, happy to sacrifice his son. When I look at Isaac, I can see a great Bible character. He was happy to accept that offering that Abraham was going to make of him. I can see this great act of faith. I can see both of those guys, both Abraham and Isaac are types of Christ. They're faithful and they're self-sacrificing. They trust in God. But at first glance, I think it's much harder to see that Jacob is a great Bible character. Or how we can see Jesus in Jacob. Where is Jesus in Jacob? Well, up until now, it's been pretty hard to see. But today, or tonight at least, in Beersheba, Jacob is Jesus. Because I think Jacob mirrors Jesus' greatest triumph. We might well debate this, but what is Jesus' greatest triumph? Is it healing? Is it turning water into wine? Is it the the beauty and the simplicity and complexity of his parables? Is it the way he dealt with the Pharisees? What is it? Even the crucifixion, for me at least, I think his greatest triumph is that moment in the garden when the world hated him. His friends couldn't even stay awake. He's hours away from torture and shame and agonizing and lonely death. And that moment when he says to God, look, I don't really want to do this, but it's not my will, but yours that needs to be done. And I think today, or tonight, in Beersheba, Jacob is Jesus. He goes against his natural inclination to just jump in there and just do his own thing, to wrestle with his own hands. And he says to God, look, I know my boy's just over the horizon, but not my will, but yours be done. And so that's the man Jacob becomes, relinquished everything, everything to God. So we're close to finished. So if I was to ask you to write Hebrews chapter 11, do you think you would have got it? Do you think you would have gotten? Do you think you would have nailed all the examples? Like if I said, you know, I want you to write about Abraham, would you write what's in Hebrews chapter 11? Probably would have. Noah, you probably would have got that one. He built a boat, right, when it hadn't rained. You'd probably get them. What if I asked you, what about Jacob? What would you have written about Jacob? What's his great moment of faith? What would you have scribed in Hebrews chapter 11? Would it have been Bethel and the ladder? What about Jabbok and the wrestle with the angel? Would that have been when he finally, I'm going to hold on to this angel? Would it be altars and pillars? Would it be that he just valued and was jealous for the being the head of the family? Would it be tonight, waiting at Beersheba? Well, I think in Hebrews chapter 11, it's a little bit surprising what is written. It says in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 21, here it is, the big moment of faith for Jacob. It's when he was dying, blessed each of Joseph's sons and worshipped as he leaned on the top of his staff. A grandfather blesses his grandkids. That's a big act of faith. And an old man leans on a stick. Is that a big act of faith? So, I'll risk it here. I'm going to ask you to tell me, why does Hebrews 11 say it's a great act of faith for Jacob to be leaning on his staff with his head bowed? What have we learnt? What's that kind of telling us? Why is that a faithful act when it comes to Jacob? Yeah, give it. And why do you say that's give it all to God? I mean, I've leant on plenty of sticks and I don't reckon I was giving it all to God at the time. So why is it giving it all to God? I agreed. Tell me about the stick. When do you reckon he started needing a stick, Randy? Right after he wrestled with the angel. Exactly. Right after he learnt that I need to what? What did he learn? To lean on God. And I've got to hold on to that angel. That's what I want. And so what you have here is a symbol that we need to understand. Jacob, to understand why this is of great faith. This symbol, this staff, becomes a symbol of his relationship with God. And God says, I'll show you what worship is. You know, worship isn't, you know, necessarily for this man. It's not, you know, doing great acts. It's not running around and feeding the masses or saving the poor or, you know, singing the best songs in the world. Those things are worship for some people, but for this man, his issue was he just needed to lean on God. That is worship when it comes to Jacob. He trusts in God. Trust is worship. He bows his head and he acknowledges God. Acknowledging God is worship. And Eric reminded us what the blessing of the grandsons, what that looked like. Show us again, Eric. Can you remember what that looked like? When he blessed the grandsons, it's like that. Remember that? Joseph brought the two boys up. He brought the eldest towards his right hand, and Jacob does this and crosses his hands. He blesses the youngest over the eldest. He actually goes against the natural way of things. Remember that the first thing we see of Jacob, if the Bible's a video, is his hands. The last thing we see is his hands. But Jacob, in the end, in faith, crosses his hands, blesses the boys against the natural order. That's Joseph's complaint. He's like, Dad, stop. Don't do that. You're blessing the wrong one. That's not the way it's done around here. You bless the old one first, then the younger one second. And Jacob says, no, I've got to a point where I understand. I don't go with the natural way of things. I intentionally have crossed my hands. Why is this important? Why is Hebrews 11 saying this is faithful? Well, Jacob realizes the natural firstborn, well, that doesn't matter. Spiritual firstborn is what matters. Order is irrelevant. Spiritual preeminence is what matters. And so Hebrews said, well, that's faith. I count that as faith. You trust God, you acknowledge God, and you say, no, I actually see the spiritual over the natural. Hebrews says that's faith. And so again, his hands finally have relinquished all to God's order and God's way. So is that relevant? That was nice for Jacob, isn't it? I mean, is that relevant to us? This idea of spiritual over natural, is that kind of relevant? Well, it's absolutely critical that we have the same glasses, the same goggles of faith as Jacob, as where he gets to. Colossians chapter 1 is a Bible lie. Are you ready for it? And it's in this very first sentence. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. Is that the truth naturally? Is Jesus the firstborn of all creation? Yes or no? Yes. Well, in spiritual goggles, the answer is yes. With these kind of goggles, the answer is yes. For by him all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. All things were created through him and for him, and he is before all things, and in him all things hold together, and he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in everything he might be preeminent. A Bible lie? No, because we see it the same way that Jacob gets to. Now, how many firstborns can there be naturally? How many? There's one, yeah, right? Okay, well, now even that's not true. Because we come unto Zion's mountain, unto the city of the living God, a heavenly Jerusalem, and unto myriads of messengers in high festival, and unto an assembly of firstborn ones. Another Bible lie, guys. No, it's not. We see things spiritually, don't we? Enrolled in the heavens, and unto God, judge of all, unto the spirits of righteous ones made perfect, unto the mediator of a new covenant, Jesus, and unto the blood of sprinkling, more excellently speaking than Abel. Spiritually, Jesus is the firstborn, though he's not naturally. Spiritually, you are firstborns, though not naturally. And so Jacob's actions of faith are a demonstration of what he has come to understand. And so there's again this rich symbology with Jacob, with hands, and how that relates to his life and where he gets to spiritually. And the matters of faith are the very same for us. What Hebrews picks up on is the exact same test or exact same hope for us, the exact same litmus test for our faith. Do we lean on our staff? Do we just trust in God? Do we have our heads bowed? Do we acknowledge him at all times? Acknowledge God? Do we cross our arms? Are we assured? Are we convicted that things that are seen aren't important? It's the unseen that is the reality. That it's the spiritual over the natural. So 147 years ago, in the very beginning, Rebecca is told, there's actually two manner of people coming out of you, Rebecca. Two different manner, two manners. And for a while, though there's two, neither are particularly attractive. They're almost difficult to distinguish. Although when we have a bit of a closer look, we can appreciate that one of them seems to value something more than the other, value the spiritual. But in their actions, pretty tough to split. But in the end, it's only one manner of people that God is interested in. God is interested in those who have the same expression of the Lord as the Lord Jesus Christ, who have the same expression of Jacob at Beersheba when he says, "Not my will, but yours be done." And so God is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Not a surprise inclusion, and Jacob. And this is the manner of people that God is interested in. Those who are participants in common with the promise. Those whose characters aren't perfect at the beginning, but they consistently develop over time. Those who live in a tent, that is, they await the promise and believe that it will occur. Those that are part of Bethel, those who say, yeah, I understand this. This is about relationship and promise. That's what I'm interested in, relationship and promise. And those that over time, maybe even 130 years, come to learn that life is all about leaning on God, a simple trust and faith. Those that are aware that becoming a prince with God, though it may involve wrestlings, is really a very simple matter in essence. Let's just return to him. Let's just hold on to him. And let's just wait continually and patiently with him. It was a long journey for Jacob, 147 years, but in the end, we're left with a beautiful picture. A picture of his hands resting in trust, crossed in faith. And I guess we can do no better than finishing with Moses' summary. This is Jacob, a complete man living in a tent.